Coffee House Shots is sponsored by EDF, Britain's biggest generator of zero carbon electricity. Find out how we are busy helping Britain achieve net zero at www.edfenergy.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bourse. So Katie, you have an interview with Ben Wallace in the latest issue of The Spectator, where he seemed to push back on claims made by Dominic Raab early in the week that it was down to military intelligence that people didn't expect Kabul to fall so quickly. So the relationship between the two secretaries of state are going well then, is it?
Yes, it's strange in a way because we have this row that's been rumbling on for a few days now. It's not just the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office. I think it's also the Home Office. There is a blame game quite publicly playing out about who got what wrong when it comes to the chaotic UK response to Afghanistan, why the UK government was caught so surprised. And I think the issue right now is it just looks very chaotic because you've got all these competing narratives. You have Dominic Raab saying it's intelligence. You have Ben Wallace saying it's not intelligence. And then after the interview with The Spectator, where Ben Wallace made those comments on intelligence and said as early as July, he was saying plans had to be ramped up. We today had Dominic Raab on his trip to the Middle East, giving a clip where he said, well, myself and Ben Wallace were in lockstep for a large part of this. And it just feels as though everyone just keeps adding fuel to the flames when at this point you would have thought someone in Downing Street would have just tried to put a lid on it. I've spoken to MPs and some ministers who are just a little bit confused at this point as to why we still have different narratives from members of government about something which has the potential to be damaging to the government. And I think it's now becoming almost a sign of dysfunction that this row is rumbling on.
James, why haven't they put a stop to it?
I think, as Katie said, the surprise is that you've seen these differences between Ben Wallace and Dominic Raab, and that they have now been going on for quite some time, kind of over a week. And it is obviously problematic if the Foreign Secretary and the Defence Secretary are saying different things. Now, look, often you end up in a situation where cabinet ministers say different things. You know, the classic is spending department wants more money, but Treasury doesn't want to give it. Or you think back in the Cameron years, so the Michael Gove, Theresa May row over how best to counter extremism. But normally at some point, number 10 intervenes and says, no, both of you shut up. I mean, part of the problem is, because of the nature of this crisis, Raab and Wallace keep doing media, keep being asked about what the other one has said, and even when, as Dominic Raab today tried to say, tries to suggest that they're on the same page, it just kind of highlights the fact that they're not on the same page on some of this stuff. And so there is obviously that tension there. I also think there is an element here that you kind of, the problem is you've got kind of three departments involved in this. You've got the Minister of Defence, the Foreign Office and the Home Office. I think that is all adding to the complications. But I think there is a danger for the government if this goes on much longer. The Tory MPs and ministers who are getting increasingly baffled by why this is still happening. You know, this begins to become a kind of competence problem.
Katie, is Dominic Raab facing a department management problem as well at the Foreign Office? Is he losing respect because this seems to be continuous things leaking out from the Foreign Office about what was warned, what wasn't warned? This Tom Tugendhat principal risk register that he mentioned in the Select Committee yesterday, saying that the FCDO did know about some of the stuff that was coming out and then that was promptly leaked again. So is Dominic Raab respected within the department?
Yeah, I think Dominic Raab's more immediate problem. We keep talking about, generally, is he going to stay in his position? Will he be moved? And look, there are plenty of rumours that we might get a reshuffle in the next few weeks, so watch that space. But I think by far the most immediate issue for Dominic Raab is the fact that he seems to have a big problem in terms of leaks in his own department. And I think as soon as you have the number of leaks of details of what the Secretary of State is up to, some of which seems to be private office, a smaller group, some of it in terms of these documents, there does seem to be a point where officials are no longer on your side. And that doesn't move you from your post, but it does make your job a lot harder. And I think that's what he's now going to encounter.
And James, in non-Dominic Raab, Ben Wallace news, the NHS today has asked for more money. I mean, obviously the NHS is in a very bad situation, worse than usual with the COVID backlog. So what is it asking for, and is it to target the backlog there?
It's asking for another £10 billion. I think this is one of the political problems, is that COVID comes to an end. The Treasury instinct is, right, we can stop the crisis spending. You know, furlough comes to an end at the end of this month. The universal credit uplift comes to an end at the end of the £20 a week uplift comes to an end at the end of this month. The problem you're then going to have is all of these departments, or in the NHS case, organisations, going to start knocking on the door asking for more money. And we've already had the government's education catch-up czar, Kevin Collins, resigning because he thinks there's not enough money going into education catch-up. And I think the true thing you've got here is the NHS saying it's £10 billion just to get on top of this backlog. Now, the NHS backlog, I think, if you look at the kind of known political dangers for government, I think this is the biggest one. Sajid Javid is talking about how the NHS backlog in England could rise to 13 million. That is, waiting list could rise to 13 million. That is kind of one in four people on it. I mean, that essentially means pretty much everyone's got a blood relative on the waiting list. And that is obviously going to become a massive political problem. And I think one of the things that you're going to see is, how do you work this out, given that, you know, it is worth remembering that in all the austerity of the coalition years, the one area that was, you know, one of the few, very few areas that was protected was the NHS. That the easy cuts that, you know, George Osborne did, like changing the measure of inflation used to determine how benefits were uprated and the like, all of those things have gone. So what does the government do now, given it's so determined not to return to austerity?
I mean, Katie, is the government going to give them this money? Because we're going to a phase, as James says, where the Treasury is looking at tightening its belt again, and there's a spending review coming up later this year.
So I think the spending review is going to mean some difficult conversations with various departments, particularly because it's not just the Department of Health that has a COVID backlog. Mm. You also see that in the Ministry of Justice and others. But I think when it comes to spending priorities, we had something interesting happening in the 2019 election, in which the Tories actually spoke about the NHS. They made it front and central, whereas in the past there was almost a habit to neutralise it but not bring it up much because it's constantly something that helps Labour. And I think that therefore, when it comes to spending priorities, generally speaking, the NHS is going to be high up. But we've also got to look at the social care announcement we're expecting soon, because that is a 1% increase to the national insurance that's being mooted. And while it is for social care plans, the initial plan is that 1% uptick would be used to clear the NHS backlog. So I think we are going to see more funding for the NHS. It just is still in the air in which way it manifests itself.
And you talked to Kate Andrews in the Edition podcast this week about how the intergenerational aspect of it is incredibly unfair for a national insurance rise.
Yes, and I think we're hearing that privately from ministers and MPs, in the sense there's lots of unease about the fact that something which at least immediately is going to help those who are retired, not of the working age, is going to be heavily paid for by the working age. But as far as I can tell, this is the direction of travel. Those concerns almost are a side issue now, if that's what they're planning to press on with.
And James, speaking of young people, schools are coming back, and some of them have gone back today. Where we are at with COVID control within schools and in terms of vaccinations for the young?
I mean, I think in terms of COVID controls within schools, the government have been quite keen to avoid pupils having to mask and all this. But I thought Gavin Williamson was, again, we talked yesterday on this podcast, yesterday on our podcast, about ministerial irritation with the JCVI. And I thought it burst into the open, really, with Gavin Williamson today, when he basically made it quite clear that he was waiting and rather impatient for a decision on whether you could vaccinate 12 to 15 year olds, which would have an effect. You know, we know half of 16 to 17 year olds have received their dose of a Pfizer or a Moderna vaccine. And I think the question, I think it's a Pfizer vaccine for that age group. And I think the question now is, you know, I think the government would like to do 12 to 15 year olds, but in some ways it is perhaps too late. If you look at Scotland, this spike in cases has been very fast, and that, you know, Scottish schools go back earlier than English schools, as Katie knows well. And I think the thing that government's kind of slightly holding its breath about is what happens as these schools go back. I mean, there's, you know, and it is 13, with schools, universities and colleges all returning this month, that's 13 million people changing their kind of weekday pattern. And obviously, the numbers of how much people are socialising is still relatively depressed at the moment. But obviously, as those schools and universities go back, that, you know, that is inevitably going to lead to a rise in socialising. I mean, the kind of big question is kind of what happens then to cases. Now, I mean, there's a broad optimism that the health service will be able to cope with that. But you did see in Nicola Sturgeon's statement yesterday the first hints in Scotland that, that she is considering possibly, you know, she went for vaccine certification, but also hinting that if this spike in cases doesn't abate, that maybe you are looking at restrictions. I think the government of Westminster will be absolutely determined to avoid restrictions, but I still think that we are that this is the kind of the big moment of truth, really, is what happens when schools come back.
Katie, child vaccination is something that you've written about for The Spectator in the past, and at the time, you know, the worry is that for these young people who are not at serious risk of having a bad reaction from COVID or long COVID itself, vaccinations cost actually outweighs the benefits. I mean, presumably that's what's key holding the JCVI back. And do you think the government is, you know, in this sort of political pressure, pushing for younger vaccination, has actually just got its heart in the right place? Because if they're just wanting to be better than France, for example, is it becoming more of a headline grabbing thing rather than for the kids involved?
So I don't think it's headline grabbing. I think what you're seeing is the government, and I think opinion previously in cabinet was fairly divided on child vaccination. But I think when they look to the fact, for example, today we hear that Israel now has the highest, you know, rapid rising COVID cases, which the country that was ahead of us in terms of vaccinations. So I think as we learn more, and vaccinations don't guarantee everything, I don't think it's so much necessary about achieving herd immunity. Some doubt with Delta you can even do that, but I think there is now a consensus that vaccinating children will help. If you don't vaccinate children, schools will continue to be a hotbed for COVID cases, and not everyone is vaccinated. You look at the figures, we're really seeing, you know, the number of people in hospitals who some double vaccinated but many who have refused the vaccine. So how do you limit that? And I think this is seen as a practical step. I think where it clearly is going to come up with some issues, even though polling, I think, has suggested there is support for it generally, is the fact that who is it helping more? Is it helping society in controlling the COVID outbreak, or is it helping the individual child? And I think this sense of young children taking one for the herd is changing in a way of how we looked at vaccination in the past. But I think in a way, because everyone is so worn down by the past year and a half and the pandemic, I do wonder if they might have more support as a way to control it in the future, particularly when we're getting concerns about vaccines fading. But when it comes to the medical committee, and while they haven't yet approved it, I do think it is the case of what does it do to the individual, which is why they haven't made a bold decision yet. And you've also heard it from, I think, people like Chris Whitty and Jonathan Vanter, in the sense they've said, well, you need to think, what is it giving that child? And I think that is a perspective which, obviously, when the government are planning, they're thinking more about society.
I also think that's a fascinating question, which is the JCVI are not just responsible for the COVID vaccination campaign, they're responsible for all the vaccine campaigns in the UK. And I think one of the things that you hear privately from people close to the JCVI is like, look, you decide to stick vaccinations for 12-year-olds for COVID into this debate, what is the knock-on effect that that might have on other vaccination campaigns for children? That's something that ministers aren't really thinking about. You know, ministers are thinking about schools coming back this week and next week and what's going to happen to COVID cases. I mean, the JCVI are like, look, the UK in global terms really does not have an anti-vax movement. Vaccines have been, are broadly popular here, and you've got high levels of childhood vaccination, which is, you know, preventing lots of nasty old school diseases from getting going again. And I think their worry is, if it turns into be a huge controversy about whether you vaccinate 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds with a COVID jab, what effect might that have on other child vaccination campaigns? I think that is another thing that, you know, I mean, Katie's totally right about the difference in the way in which the JCVI are thinking about it in terms of the individual. Yeah. Government want to think about the, you know, the benefits to society, but I think the potential knock-on effects on other vaccination campaigns is the other thing holding the JCVI back.
Katie and James, thanks very much, and thank you for listening to this episode of Coffee House Shots. For that episode of the Edition podcast will be out later on Thursday evening, so you can check that out on Best of the Spectator channel, wherever you get your podcast from. And do join us again tomorrow.